The Weather Guys are back. Larry Mueller here, and I'm really pleased to have back the Weather Guys for one last time, for me at least. Steve Ackerman is the former Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And Steve, good to see you. Thanks for coming over.
It's great to be here, Larry.
John Martin with us as well, of course, the other half of the Weather Guys. He is a professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And John, good to see you.
Same here, Larry. Great to be here.
As we talk with the guys, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about recent weather patterns? Are you curious about maybe a recent weather event? Give a call. The number 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And this is a question somebody else had asked me, and I thought, you know what would be a fun way to start this? How did, maybe, what are your remembrances of how you two became the Weather Guys? Steve, you want to?
Yeah, so what I remember is, you know, because of the Wisconsin idea, like the previous guest you just had on, the importance of doing that, reaching out to the public. And John and I were both teaching 100, and we're good at it. And we thought, you know, this would be great to go on Larry's show and just answer questions if they would have us. And initially, the original producer did not, at that time anyway, did not want to guess. And so when there was an opening and he would ask through Terry Gregory at SSEC if we were available, or if I was available, I would say, it has to be us.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. And so we just wouldn't do it because it makes so much more sense. And then eventually somebody canceled like 10 minutes before your show. And so they were desperate. And John and I were both available and said, yep, we can both come.
Yeah.
And we did. And it was a great show. And we had a lot of fun, answered good questions. And at the end of that, we were laughing. And you said, we'll have to have you Weather Guys on again.
Yeah.
and that's how we got branded.
Like that. And that was 28 years ago?
Yeah. July of 1998.
Wow.
Can you believe that?
Yeah.
That's just unreal.
It's not like doing it as long as you have, but
But I'll tell you, I mean, my feeling here is that that's a great story, Steve. You have all that recollection so clearly. I saw Henry Aaron get three hits and a double off the wall at Fenway Park when I was a little boy. And I remember thinking being anywhere near such a legend was amazing. Here we've had 28 years to work with a legend. I mean, that's a whole different ballgame right there. And I just can't tell you how thankful I am for this opportunity that we've had. It's been wonderful.
Yeah. Well, thank you both. This has been so much fun over the years for me. And we always have a good time.
Yeah, it's good.
And we get some information out while we're at it. And you know what? Jude in Iola has a question that's weather-related. Let's go there. Jude, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My question is, April of this year and April of last year, we had 2 years consecutively, same month, of ice storms. Is this going to turn out to be like the norm?
Ice storms in 2025, April, and April of 2026.
They are so local that one would, even over the whole length of the winter, one would probably hesitate to suggest that there's some trend in ice storms. And I don't say that without thinking about it, because I think that there may be trends in precipitation, but boy, to get ice, we didn't have that here in Madison, as far as I remember. And so it's very, very local, has to do with orography, has to do with a little bit of cold pool that might sit around a little longer in one spot than another. I hope that it's not a trend for you, because it's no fun. It's the worst winter weather element, in my opinion. But I wouldn't, I'd say we have zero confidence in making a statement about it one way or the other.
Yeah. Just bad luck for those 2 years. Yeah,
bad luck.
Yeah.
Jude, thank you. Jonah in New London, we'll go to you. Hi, Jonah.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my question. So I know different states are affected by climate change in different ways. You know, like California's been dealing with much harsher droughts. The East Coast has had crazy blizzards. Here in Wisconsin, it just seems like things are getting wetter. It's just more rain, more flooding, and the area that I live in, the Fox Valley, has seen quite a lot of flooding. I don't know if you've been to New London or Fremont or any of those areas, but it got pretty crazy a month ago. So my question is, are there any county or even especially like state level funds for flood relief, not private, you know, corporations squeezing you for money for relief?
Or plans to create one?
That's a good question. Given the political environment we're in right now, I would guess that there's probably none at the federal level. But they're usually, if you have flood insurance, so we live on the mouth of a river that feeds one of the lakes in here in Madison, and we do have flood insurance. And we use that one year, I can't remember what the year was, but you know, it covered up half of our property.
Might have been
property.
16 or 18. There 18, was a flood in August of one of those 2 years. I forget which one, too.
So that might be the best way, I think.
Yeah, and then the other thing, to maybe get back to the meteorology as opposed to the public policy, there is a there's predictions as the climate warms that there'll be more frequent extreme precipitation events. That may not mean that we have more total for the summer, but it might mean we have more of those really big ones that, in fact, that's what causes a flash flood, is the heavy rain that can't run off. And so if it comes in a big downpour, it's a little more likely to do some property damage and cause havoc than it is if it's a sort of an all-day-long moderate rain event. So those things are supposed to become a little bit more frequent, perhaps a lot more frequent 100 years from now. And so there is that threat.
Yeah. Amy in Appleton emailed us, do you know if there has ever been a day in the United States weather history when the whole country basically had clear skies? Is that even possible?
I would think it's extremely low probability of being possible.
Yeah.
Even if you allow for 10 or 20% cloud cover. The systems that generate weather and clouds are just too big on that scale that you're going to have cloudiness someplace.
Yeah, and the first thing that pops into my mind at that really fabulous question is, what about a winter day where you get a really desperate cold air outbreak over the eastern two-thirds of the continent? Okay, the eastern two-thirds may have little or no clouds and therefore not much precipitation, but in the immediately of the lakes under those conditions, there'll be snow. And then everywhere in the Intermountain West, usually that comes along with some low clouds. They may not precipitate. So a day with no clouds, I can't imagine it over our vast country.
That's pretty interesting.
And then include Alaska and Hawaii.
No
way.
Yeah, that makes sense. And if something's happening where you've got clear skies in one part of the country, it's going to probably mean that there's
weather on the other side.
Well, I guess another way to look at it is the country has a scale that exceeds the scale of an average weather system.
We're
between one or the other. We're either dominated in one half of the country by an anticyclone where the weather is nice, or a cyclone somewhere else. So we're just too big.
And to kind of go along with that, Tom called, couldn't stay with us, and wondering what's the difference between partly cloudy and partly sunny?
Whether or not you're an optimist. I think. I mean, honestly, I don't know the difference myself.
I think there are definitions with regard to percent cloud cover or percent open, but I think it's also, you know, do you want to be optimistic or pessimistic?
Oh, man. Rob in Port Edwards, your turn. Hi, Rob.
Hi. Good afternoon, gentlemen, and great show as always. Thank you so much. I have a question, as you gentlemen are all in academia. Whether this is with the UW Systems Studies or some other college institution, has anybody really truly established the costs to the public, to the general public, for the costs of global warming and climate change? I'm hearing callers come in and say they got flooded, they had ice storm, they had this, that, the other thing. There has to be a fiscal impact that all of the individuals that say, oh, there's no such thing as global warming, we don't need it, we can't afford to make a change, we have to stay the course. Is there an impact?
Yes, there sure is. We're involved along with Northern Illinois University, a lot of researchers here, myself included, and a colleague, with an NSF program that is addressing exactly that in an interesting way. We're partnering with businesses, mostly insurance companies and some others that deal with the interface between disaster and the public, to try and inform them a little bit more about what the meteorological hazards are and how they may be changing. And they're informing us about what the needs are in that industry for different types of information that comes from experts who know about the weather and the climate. So it's a really fertile place where we're building this collaboration. It would never go were it not for the fact that this change is incurring enormous costs. There are more billion-dollar weather disasters in the wintertime than there are in the summertime in the continental United States, and they are on the rise. And so insurance companies have trouble in certain instances in certain locations meeting their book being who they've insured for what cost, because the cost of materials for replacement has gone so far out of whack, and the weather has gotten worse. And so there's some serious cost to that. And I think, you know, the people who might be skeptical about climate change, they are not insurance executives. They're not military generals. I can tell you that. People who see this stuff day to day and know what the threats are and the emerging threats, they're not skeptical.
Yeah. That sounds like a really cool collaboration.
It's a great collaboration. We're in year one of it right now. Yeah. And so we're excited. It's gone well for us, gone well for the consortium. Very, very exciting possibilities.
Yeah, that's really cool. Bob in Claybanks has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry. My question's actually one for the guys and one for you. For the weather guys, I wondered what's coming down the pike as far as technology improvements for weather forecasting. I think they do a great job right now, but I'm wondering what we can look forward to.
That's a good question. Yeah. And I think the main thing that comes to my mind is to get a good weather forecast, you need good models and good data feeding those models. And I think the models are improving, and what we need is continued good observations to feed those models.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think we also have, waiting in the wings, it's not really in the wings anymore, it's part of the enterprise, is the extraordinary potential of artificial intelligence to inform aspects of the forecast process, not just for the short term, but medium range as well. Now, if that happens, people get overexcited about that at the expense of maintaining an observational network. That's a disaster waiting to happen. Yeah. If we do both, if we explore the applications of AI and maintain and enhance the observations, we'll be in a really different place 20 years from now.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah,
wow.
I think so.
Bob, thank you. Oh, and you had a question for me?
Yes, I do. It's been great listening to you. I pretty much listen to you most of the day. Being a house painter, it makes the paint dry faster, it seems like. and you've answered questions that I didn't even know I had. But I was just thinking, you know, pro sports, they retire the number, you know, it retires. And I wonder if you're going to retire the phone number and let your replacement earn his own number.
What an excellent idea.
You know, that is not entered into our thought process. I was thinking about a number that I did get. In 2017, I was at the, we did a special evening show at Lambeau Field. Mm. And I was on with the general manager and with the historian for them, and they presented me with my own Packer jersey.
That's pretty choice.
With my name on the back and the number 50, because that was the year that I went 50 years on the air.
Wow.
Wow.
That's pretty awesome.
No, I don't think they retired the number 50. But
yeah.
And I've worn it a few times that people say to me, oh, did you have a relative playing for the Packers? Bob, thank you very much. I think they're going to keep the number because it's an easy one for everybody to remember now. It's been going on for a long, long time. Thank you so much. Oh, man. The Weather Guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. We're taking a look at climate and weather. Just to let you know, tomorrow on the show, kind of a special show that celebrates our time together on WPR. I'll be joined by Lee Rayburn and Jill Nadeau, and we'll hear some recorded messages, I think, from longtime guests. That's tomorrow at 11. But right now it's climate and weather, and Andrew in Waterford has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Larry. First of all, I just have to say thank you for everything you've done. You've been the soundtrack of my weekdays for longer than I can remember, and I kind of set the calendar by whether it's, you know, the third Monday or a Wildlife Wednesday or so on. And so I'm going to miss you for sure.
Thank you.
My question for the weather guys, we live in Waterford in southeastern Wisconsin, got struck by one of the small tornadoes back in April, and we had a stretch of 4 out of 5 nights where we had tornado warnings. But prior to that, it had been pretty much crickets for severe weather, sometimes seemingly for whole seasons. And similarly in the winter, we haven't had a lot of snow, where we have pictures from 10 years ago of the kids climbing in trees because the snow mounds are so high. In the last 4 or 5 years, there's been nothing. And my question is this related in some way to the La Nina / El Nino that seems to be happening every year now? I feel like years ago those were rarer, and now they're happening all the time, and there's an El Nino coming back again, it sounds like. So that's my question.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I would say with regard to hearing about El Nino and La Nina, it's generally we're better understanding it, and that's probably why we're hearing more about it. La Nina in the wintertime, I know John's very depressed about this. We get less snowfall in general. But coupled on top of that is, you know, we're getting a warmer climate well, and that's going to reduce the probability of snowfall.
Yeah, those are really excellent points. And, you know, so the El Nino-La Nina cycle is irregular, and it does play some role in our winter weather, which would be, you know, the El Nino that we're looking forward to, as Steve pointed out. It's going to be a pretty strong one by all accounts, by all forecasts, and that probably means an impact on the snow in the southern part of the state that will be negative. But I think the other thing that's going on is that, as Steve points out, it's not just that we understand it better, but the media has paid attention a little bit more to that increased understanding. So even minor events, well, what would have qualified as minor 30 years ago, get mentioned now. And so it's part of the universe that everybody has in their head when they're thinking about how come the weather is so boring this winter. And so there's a little bit of that as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, people want to know the weather a month from now, next season, and El Nino, La Nina, that cycle helps do that forecasting, which is why they're probably talking about it more.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Andrew, thank you. Rick in Portage County, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Larry. I just want to preface this by telling you that you have helped me, been listening since the 80s to you, and you have helped me remodel 2 houses and hand split I don't know how many cords of wood.
Wow.
I just wanted to thank you for all your help.
Oh, thanks, Rick. I don't have any blisters on my hand from that, though.
Yeah. That's the best kind of help, isn't it?
Yeah. But you had a question.
Yes, I did. And so the question is that my wife and I were driving down the road the other day, and it was one of those puffy cumulus cloud kind of days and all blue sky around it. And we saw a funnel cloud come down out of one cloud, and this was way up, and essentially it seemed to go into the cloud below it that lasted about 10 or 15 seconds, and then the cloud just kind of retracted and went up into the cloud above it.
Wow, cool.
And I'm wondering, is there a phenomenon? Or what's the explanation for that? Thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Rick.
Well, you know, when you talk about, you know, the cumulus-type clouds, not thunderstorms, when you mention funnel, what I'm wondering about, is it Virga? So rain falling out that's evaporating and maybe feeding the cloud below it, because that kind of looks like a funnel as it comes out of the cloud.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm done.
And or on a day where you do get those kind of cumulus clouds, you have an increasingly unstable boundary layer, lowest part of the atmosphere, and so there just might be enough buoyancy-generated vorticity to spin something up, and it won't last long usually. I had friends who would drive, when I was in Seattle, they'd drive to the plains of central Nevada, and on a day where they expected it was going to be kind of warm, and sometimes they'd see these gigantic dust devils that were lifting hay bales. And it was, I think you can imagine concocting a scenario that's like that over Wisconsin. When you get cumulus clouds, they're a function of the destabilization of the daytime heating, and you might just get a few vortices out of that in a similar way.
They're real weather nerds if they're going to drive all the way to Nevada.
It's unbelievable to think about that now. Yeah, I mean, who would do that? But you know, these people have had fabulous careers, too. So pretty amazing. But, yeah, that might be what it is. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, Rick, there you go. Thanks very much for calling. By the way, you can join in, too. The number, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And if you have a photo, a weather photo you want to send, we can see it on our screen here at the studio. Talk@WPR.org. Send us a weather photo. We'll always love to see those. Rich and Nina, we'll go to you now. Hi, Rich.
Good morning. Good morning, Larry. I had a study that UW-Madison was working with, and this was where the Edmund Fitzgerald, coming up, study, I guess that would be the title of this study, of repeating itself as far as weather. A low pressure system would come out of Colorado, and then it would go up to the Lake Superior area, and this is what they traced from the time that it happened. And since then, the weather, they haven't seen a repeat, but similar repeats of weather traveling up from Colorado. Is there anything more that you can maybe get from other callers that would just talk about that?
Yeah. So, yeah, there is a path where these low-pressure systems tend to develop just east of the Rockies in the panhandle of Oklahoma and Texas in the fall. And as they get organized via the jet stream up above, they head right towards the Great Lakes. And that's a storm we saw in the 1975 storm that sank the Fitzgerald. We also saw that in 1940 in the Armistice Day storm, which occurred around that same time. And then also we saw it in 1998. And that was actually really well forecast because of the models got better and the observations. So I think that climatology is going to continue. Whether or not you get that kind of severe storm, I think it's still going to be infrequent. Just like the other ones have been.
I completely agree. I mean, if you kept track of every storm that comes by in the fall, you'd see a large fraction of them follow that path. But as Steve points out, not many of them develop into that deeply intense storm. But those that do are memorable, always.
Rich, thank you very much for calling. Daniel emailed us. Daniel says there's unusually hot water off of South America, or warm water off the ocean. Does that mean fewer Atlantic hurricanes? Would that mean?
I don't know. Where in South America? Okay. Is it indicated? I don't know.
No, exactly. It just says usually hot water off, unusually hot water off South America.
Let's imagine it's the northeast coast of the continent.
Yeah.
That's kind of the southern part of the Caribbean. It's possible it has some influence on the Atlantic hurricane season, but I think that's a pretty peripheral influence.
Yeah,
is my guess. It's a little too far south to be right in the heart of things in the next couple of months as they start to really churn up.
Yeah, we want to see with a warmer water more in the Gulf and off the east coast of the U.S.
Gulf of Mexico, the main heart of the Caribbean, if that's unusually warm.
And then the
then
dynamics, of course, to generate it, not just the warm water.
That's right.
Yeah. So there you go. Thank you so much for that question. And again, you can join in at 800-642-1234. You could email us to talk@WPR.org. Paul in Darlington has a question for us. Let's go there. Paul, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I was wondering what have on the humidity levels in Wisconsin?
Well, you broke up in the beginning, but Paul's question, I think, relates to cornfields.
Cornfields have humidity. I know there's humid days down here in the south. I know that that's an issue when it gets nice and hot here in the summertime.
So
the fields.
For sure. The humidity from coming from corn.
Yeah. We'll feed it.
And we're beginning the peak season for that because it kind of wanes by the end of July, but right in the middle of July, that's the peak time where the corn is actually pumping water that's been put onto it, whether by irrigation or precipitation, right back into the air.
It goes right back in the air. So there you go, Paul. Thank you very much for calling. Here's an email or a listener who called but couldn't stay with us. They're wondering if there are any studies about positive impacts of climate change, if any.
Well, it depends on how you define positive.
Yeah.
I mean, if you like hot, sticky weather, then that might be a positive. If you don't like snowfall, that might be a positive. I think the more important question from my perspective is, we know what's happening. What are we going to do about it?
I think one thing that starts to occur to me is that of all the parts of the country that are going to, I mean, we're all going to be affected, and one of the earlier callers was correct in saying that not going to be the same effect everywhere, but, you know, the desert Southwest is probably going to get less, more arid and hotter, more wildfire risk in California, and so on. You can go down the list. One place that may get a little bit of benefit in its wintertime and a little bit of a change in its summertime that might be viewed as positive is the Great Lakes states. I mean, the Great Lakes states may not be as cold as they used to be. People are afraid of that from a distance. And then we don't get the same sort of frequency and intensity of severe weather. And that is not likely to change very much in the next 20 or 30 years. So we might be a climate haven. You know,
Don't say that too loud. We don't want a lot of people moving here.
Well, I know. We had a big tree come down on June 10th, so we've been hit pretty hard by an event. But that's just a regular event, not anything unusual.
That's true.
Yeah, but you think about water. I mean, you look at Canada, you look at Minnesota, you look at Wisconsin. I mean, water. If you're right about Arizona and that part of the,
we're water rich here.
Yeah. We're water rich.
Yeah.
And so is Canada.
Yep.
Yeah.
That portends well for us, but it could also portend politics could come into play.
Anytime there's an uneven distribution of important resources, you're going to have some issues unless you get really wise people running the show. So,
Ed in Lodi, what's on your mind?
Well, first, I want to congratulate you on all your years of service.
Thank you.
And second is, we've been skirting, you know, climate change, and I have skeptics say it's a cycle and so forth, but it was bound to cycle the total environment. Like, I agree with them. I say it's a cycle, but we used to have 2 billion people. Now we got 8 billion people. We got a lot more construction. And, you know, more pumping of CO2 into the air, more of the total environment. I wonder if they'd comment on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, there's always background natural cycles going on. There's a whole bunch of them, in fact. You could imagine a far-flung machine where different gears of different sizes are running all the time. That's kind of what the climate system is like. But we've imposed on it, in very short order, an extraordinary change to the whole thing, which is unprecedented. It's never been witnessed before by this whole system on our planet. And that imposition has fostered obvious changes to the way the weather and the climate behave on our planet. And it's well beyond the point where that can now be denied. And it's well beyond the point where someone could subsume it as part of a naturally occurring cycle. It is not a naturally occurring cycle. And it's time to really pay attention to that. That does not mean that naturally occurring cycles can't exacerbate it or in some instances ameliorate aspects of it. A little bit of sandpaper on a rough spot. But overall, we're heading the wrong direction, and it's our fault.
Well said.
Yeah. Ed, thank you for calling. Peter in Appleton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Peter.
Hi. With global warming, I would imagine that the average daily temperature data has been rising. But how about the standard deviation of that data? Is that changing, thinking about this week's weather coming?
Hmm.
That's a good question. I haven't looked at what this
average daily temperatures and standard deviation.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the variability in extreme weather is has increased, and that leads me to, you know, surmise that probably the variability in temperature extremes has probably also done that. Although it's been biased toward warm extremes, you know, we don't get cold extremes anymore in the northern hemisphere in the wintertime or in the summertime, and so I know the whole. The whole distribution has shifted to the warmer side, but I don't know if it's gotten less variable. It's probably gotten more variable in some of the measured quantities that we care about in the atmosphere. Precipitation certainly has.
Yeah. All right. Peter, thank you. Tom in Green Bay, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I spend part of my year in southern Mexico in the city of Oaxaca, and the last couple of years we've had storms that the Pacific they're calling them hurricanes now. They used to not call them hurricanes, but Pacific hurricanes that would blow all the way across the isthmus of Mexico, and then they'd regather and they become a hurricane in the Caribbean. I was wondering if that's a new phenomenon, and if so, what does it mean for the Caribbean then?
I'll take a crack at this.
Yeah, good.
I think that it's probably... a little bit more common now than it was 100 years ago, but it's not so common that it's become a leading factor in the Atlantic hurricane season. I think that to traverse the isthmus, whether it's Mexico or even further south, is an arduous task for a vortex structure like a hurricane, because it's got to go over all this differing, varying topography. It's all vegetated. There's a lot of friction to wear that vortex down. So not much of it resides or exists, I should say, in the far western Gulf of Mexico when it emerges from the high terrain of the isthmus. The little bit that does might occasionally spin something up that can kind of regenerate itself. But I'll bet you that's been happening forever. And it may just be that some of the vortices that stray off the Pacific track are a little stronger today than they were 100 years ago, and those are the ones that make it. So they may be a little bit more frequent, but still not a leading factor in the Atlantic season.
And in the and hurricanes occur in the Atlantic.
Yeah, yeah.
In the tropical, they're called tropical cyclones.
Yeah. When they're
right.
not quite
so, they're
that
not
strength.
Called hurricanes. So yeah. I'm wondering if they're calling them hurricanes now as they transition across Mexico. If that's going to lead to more confusion.
Yeah. Could be more confusion just because of words. Yeah,
just because
you
using
mean.
Verbiage.
Because
yeah.
they, you know, as they're dying as a vortex structure, and that's what really gains them the designation meteorologically as a hurricane, they can still precipitate like crazy. So you might have enormous amounts of rain as they die over the Isthmus Mountainous regions. And if people are mistakenly calling them hurricanes in that state, that's a good point. Yeah. That might be what's going on here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tom, thank you. Appreciate it. Glenn in Glen Arbor, Michigan. Hi.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for your show. It's made me feel so good over the years.
Thank you.
Over here in Michigan, we've had a couple of, two so far, tornadic water spouts, they say, are rare. Mm. And this is in a year where we've already broken the norm for any category of tornado, I guess. Are there going to be more tornadic? You know, most of these are EF0, I guess, and smaller or around that. Are there going to be more of these?
Boy, I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, you're right. They're weak vortices like EZeros. But
one thing that's interesting in my read of the not so much the literature, but the scientists who will come through our department who are talking about an increase in extreme weather events. Occasionally, we'll get a speaker who's a real expert in that. And when it pertains to the spring and summertime, it often means convective, heavy rains. But they don't often talk about the intensity of the convection itself, which might be a factor in leading to whether there's more or less tornadoes. It's mostly a discussion about overall precipitation. So I don't know the answer. I don't know if anybody's really made a clear statement about that either.
Yeah.
Glenn, there you go. Thank you for calling in. Dean in Evergreen, Colorado. Your turn. Hi, Dean.
Hey, folks, and thank you, Larry, for all these years of hosting the show.
We're
going to miss you.
Thank you.
We're sailors, believe it or not, stuck in the middle of Colorado, but we've spent a good bit of time going back and forth across the Gulf of Mexico and up the eastern seaboard from Bahamas north and south, and One thing that we've looked for, which I think might be folklore, but I just wanted to ask the weather guys, is something called a green flash. And I'm a meteorologist, but I've never in my recollection of taking atmospheric radiation courses seen evidence for something like that. But a number of people have said they've seen a green flash, which occurs near sunset or sunrise. But I can't physically explain why there should be a green flash.
I can remember looking for that when I spent time in the Caribbean.
I remember looking for that, too, and I have not seen it. There was an atmospheric science, Greg Bourne, from Penn State, who did a lot of work on atmospheric optics. And he explained what the green flash is. And what it is you look for it at sunset or sunrise. I think sunset is more common because you have the right vertical temperature structure so that the light bends as a function of what the temperature of the atmosphere is or really what the density is. And so there are times that you can get just the right bright flash of green just above the sunset. And I've seen pictures of
it. Me too.
But I've never seen it physically. And I have looked.
I've not seen it live either. I've heard that those stability conditions that will do the refraction are better over the cold California current. So if you're on the West Coast looking at the sunset, that's a better time to try and hope to see it.
Yeah.
Might not set up in the Caribbean as well. But I've got I saw a fantastic picture taken by Larry Radke and Peter Hobbs's group that was undeniably a green flash. So it happens.
Yeah. It does happen.
But it's rare.
Good talking to you this one last time. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Our guests, I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking weather and climate with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Great to have them back. And we have callers online. Let's go to Barbara in Glenwood, Iowa. Barbara, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. I'm still a little emotional from your last guest calling you the spirit of Wisconsin.
Oh.
And thank you for all your goodness and kindness over the years. And your previous weather guys talking about other events that have occurred in our history. When I was younger, I heard about the Dust Bowl and I was horrified. Now I live in a place where dust from the Lost Hills blows in every day, and especially on these high temperature days. I wipe it off and I'm almost thinking, as I look out at the farm fields through my windows, can we have another Dust Bowl?
Mm-hmm. Barbara, thank you for your comments and for your question. Could we have another one?
I don't see why we couldn't.
Yep.
If it gets hot and dry and you lose the vegetation and you pick up some winds, and dust storms are no fun things to be in.
No, they are not. And I'll have to say, couple that with an anti-science view that is pervasive, unfortunately. You're not going to trust the experts who can tell you how to manage the land to avoid it. Yeah, the natural variability of the weather can come along, but if you exacerbate that by being foolish about how you manage the land, yeah, it could happen.
Yep.
Why not?
Barbara, it could. Thank you very much for calling. Phil in Marshfield, your turn. Hi, Phil.
Hello, Larry.
Hi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to share this story with you while you're still there because you may have had a similar experience. Fishing out of Boulder Junction up north with a guide. And we're out on the lake, and we see a thunderstorm on the horizon. And as you know, those big northern lakes, you can see 2 or 3 miles at least in the distance. Thunderstorm is so far away, we can see lightning illuminating the clouds, but we can't hear the thunder. Mm. We cast our lines out, and a strange thing begins to happen. Our lines just arc up into the air and our bait kind of dimples the water. And before I can close the bail on my spinning reel, line keeps pulling out and arcing up into the air. And our guide saw that and he said, "Boys, reel them in. We're getting off the water."
Yeah.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
The good call. That's right. A guy who earned his pay.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah, you're in a very static electric environment there when when you're
and
fishing
there's
line
lightning
stays up.
There
and
all around you.
Yep. Just because you can't hear it.
Yep.
If you can see it. Then,
it's electric.
Yeah, it's electric.
Jeepers.
And it's dangerous.
Oh, man. Thank you, Phil, for that experience. I have to think about some of my own fishing experiences. I've had a few. Mary emailed us with a picture, and it's of clouds. And the clouds, what I thought of, it reminded me almost of in the wintertime when your car, the tread in the snow. And that's kind of what it looks like.
Yeah,
it does. It's a fascinating picture. At first, when it was small, I was trying to figure out, you know, how did the clouds get to be like that? But I'm wondering now if it was a uniform cloud, and you know, like a plane went above it and precipitated some particles into it,
that's interesting.
And caused the areas of the cloud to just precipitate out and leave behind the sky.
Yeah, that's one possibility. The other is that it's near orography, but I don't know why it would be limited to a train track sort of structure. But the undulations would be maybe orographic, but I don't know about the boundaries on the north and south side of it. Did she tell where it came from?
No.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That's which is too bad.
Yeah.
And that's a railroad track.
Yeah.
If you painted it all white with the ties, that's what it looks
like.
Yeah,
it's a really interesting picture.
Really fascinating. Mary, thanks for sending that photo along. Charles in Mount Horeb, we'll go to you. Hi, Charles.
Hi, first-time caller. So I kind of wanted a question about, I had a question about, like, you know, the CO2 production that we've been maintaining as a Earth. You know, my understanding is that CO2 production has been going up and up and up and up, and we've been trying to reduce that with different things like solar, nuclear, you know, more green technologies. My question is, within the foreseeable future, are we ever going to reach a point in which we're truly like carbon neutral, to where we're not adding to the actual CO2 levels and we'll actually start seeing a production in the future? Or is that kind of like just what's the possibility of that?
I think it's a good goal and an important goal. And rather than trying to predict whether or not it will happen, I think it's important to know that we need to get towards that and start working towards that. Because if we don't start working towards it, we'll never get there.
Yeah, and the question then is also, how do you engineer that? I mean, that's a thing that requires a plan. You lay out a plan and then you execute it step by step. And, you know, if the powers that be don't even want to hear the plan, you're not going to make any progress. So we have to wait, I guess, a while until we have a more receptive audience to a plan. But there are plenty of plans out there. We had an agreement around the world some years ago that's been trashed. That was a plan to reduce fossil fuels. And, you know, people will sometimes say, why does the United States have to lead? Well, of course we have to lead. I don't even understand that question, to be honest.
Of course we have to lead.
Yeah, that's right. You know, here we are, 250 years old. We talk about having national pride. That's an example of being proud of your nation. We should lead that crusade. So I hope we can do that. But Steve's right. We need a plan, and then we need to have the will to execute the plan.
Well, and I go back to thinking about the ozone layer, and we've talked about this. Mm-hmm. There was a time when we
were worried about, and we were, due to some chemical freons that were getting up into the ozone layer, destroying the ozone layer. And that protected us, the ozone layer protected us from UV radiation. And the globe came up with a plan of how to reduce that. And we've done that and succeeded somewhat.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's less than 40 years ago.
Yeah, less than 40 years. And it was a global problem.
Right.
That, you know, we, and I say now we as the U.S., took a lot of leadership in making that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, amazing success.
Yeah.
Perry and Oconto, your turn. Hi, Perry.
Yes, and I think that shows really hit that off was All in the Family. Archie Bunker talked about that.
Boy, there's a remembrance,
yeah.
But my question is, do we have any plan of rainfall for this summer, and what typically is the wettest month of summer? I'm thinking it's July.
So do we have a prediction for summer rainfall? And what's the...
Boy, I don't remember.
I don't know if I remember it either, but I think July is a really good guess. It might be the peak of precipitation for the whole year, actually. I think that's not at all a bad guess. I'd put my money on that even blindly because that makes the most sense to me. In terms of a prediction for this coming summer, I don't know if I've heard it that if there's any particular reason why it should be abnormal dry or moist up here. And I haven't seen that. The last time we had a weather discussion in the department was early May. And at that time, there was about equal chances for about the same June, July, and August as normal. But that could have changed with the El Nino brewing, I suppose. But I don't know that it has.
Perry, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And Steve, I know you had a question or two for me.
Yes. I have two questions. One is, what's the first weather event that you remember ever? And what was the worst weather you've been in?
Oh, first one I remember. I think I remember when I was a kid on the farm, we had to do some work. We had the sow had some baby pigs, and the sows, and so we had a number of them, and we had to do something with those baby pigs. And it was really, really cold. And I was sort of out there to help Dad with that. And I remember just freezing my hands.
That's awful.
And coming back in, and then you know what happens when things warm up.
Chilblains. Oh my goodness.
I was in a lot of pain. Excuse me. I was in a lot of pain for that. So that's probably. And worst weather experienced. And this goes back, we had that question earlier about fishing. I was fishing with my brothers and my dad on the Turtle Flambeau flowage, and a tornado struck. And we were staying at Tuts Landing, you know, just these little cabins with no basement or any place to go, really. And I'm looking out the window, and about 50 feet in the air and about maybe 50, 60 yards out, about 50 feet in the air came a boat.
Oh, my God.
A fishing boat.
Wow.
Twirling in the air and then dropping on one of the cabins off in the distance, dropping right on actually it was on the porch. So it crashed through the...
I'm guessing that wasn't in the brochure.
No, that was not in the brochure.
Jeez.
And there was another guy. And, of course, you didn't get out of there for, you know, the trees and that.
Wow.
You had to drive in quite a long ways through the woods to get to Bill's Tuts Landing. And it was took a long time to get the trees and stuff out so we could ever get out of there.
Wow.
And I knew there was one other guy who was out on the lake fishing when that came up. We didn't see him later. He had gotten into an island and got on the lee side of the island and got into a little depression and survived it. But to watch that fishing boat. 50 feet in the air, kind of twirling in the air and then dropping down. That was
scary.
That was a scary experience.
Yeah.
Well, it's been great 28 years.
Well,
I agree.
So you don't forget us. We got you a little goodbye gift. So if you ever want to know where the weather is at your house, you can pop open that little weather station.
My gosh.
So thanks for having us on back in 1998.
It's been a lot of fun. And never be uninformed. I mean, it's a perfect underline for the Larry Mueller Show.
Well, I appreciate this very much. I don't have one, and now I do. And it's been a real joy being with you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, friends for 28 years here. on WPR News. And I'm hoping they'll still stick around. They'll be with us. I'm Larry Mueller, and thank you for listening.